Now let's go to our consideration in the second part of chapter 5, infertility treatments. And here we continue to see the masterful abilities of Dr. Van Drunen to help us sort out ethical questions in terms of the things that are ethically absolutely clear. He is always completely against being definitive or being dogmatic where Scripture is not clear. But he also shows us how to bring a Christian understanding of our humanity and our relationships in life socially as well as to God and bring those to bear on some of these difficult questions. And notice the first thing he says on page 129 now is that there are some cases where that medicine is actually able to cure infertility. I don't know much about these treatments at all, but this is possible. And of course, he says this is within the ordinary purposes of medicine. That might be a throwaway statement, you just pass it over, but don't, because this is therapy. That's what medicine is designed to do. It's to be therapeutic. That is, it's to bring healing to our sick bodies. And so if infertility, it would be an imperfection. And so therapy is part of the medical profession's duty. And that is distinguished in this book, Beyond Therapy. Beyond, well, what's the beyond? Well, it's enhancement. And, of course, in the baseball world, the sports world, you see this with steroids. It's enhancing muscle power, of course, deteriorating a lot of other things down the road. But that's enhancement. And that's really what Cass and the others on the committee were arguing against, or at least raising the moral, the ethical, and even the medical difficulties of enhancement. And so now we're going to be looking at infertility treatments that you know, they're flirting with this boundary between therapy and enhancement. And so there are three basic areas that we look at. One is third-party parents. Doubt that anyone in this room is going to be arguing against this, but it's important to see, I mean arguing in favor of it, but and he ultimately doesn't come out in favor of it, but it's important to see why that is the case. We can't just say, well, it's not biblical, because, in fact, the Bible doesn't really say much directly about third-party parenting. And then also, how about infertility treatments that involve one only husband and wife? Those would seem to be the morally the safest, but there are questions that we should raise there. And then finally, the most bizarre of enhancements is human cloning, which, of course, is still in its, no pun intended, infant stage of development. It's not a reality yet, but it's something certainly that some people somewhere are working on feverishly so that we can have Dolly, the baby girl that's been cloned, rather than just the sheep. So we look then at third-party possibilities or options, and there are three of these: artificial insemination, in vitro fertilization, and surrogate motherhood. And so artificial insemination is when, of course, a man other than the husband contributes semen. Now, there's also the possibility of the husband contributing the semen, but that's ordinarily the general practice, is that a man other than the husband contributes the seed. And then the in vitro IVF is when egg and sperm, one comes from a third-party donor, is joined in the laboratory to form an embryo. And incidentally, the artificial insemination, we're dealing just with the third-party version of that. The other, which would be the, I think he calls it, what does he call it, AIH. So it would be artificial insemination, husband donating the sperm. So that's morally much easier than the third-party view. And then the other one is a surrogate mother, where the surrogate mother, a husband and wife, contribute their sperm and egg to create an embryo through in vitro fertilization and reach an agreement with a third-party woman to be the surrogate in which or in whom the embryo is placed. And so what are some of the most fundamental moral dilemmas that come up? There may even be just a basic fundamental moral dilemma. And we don't have to stick only to what Van Drunen has said. I think he's covered the basis pretty well. But what are thoughts on that? With all of these, just the idea of having a third party, whether it's a surrogate mother or contributing seed or egg, what problems would we have? Lauren? Okay, well, that's it. And you probably don't have the advantage of having read the book. So, but you got right at Lauren, and by the way, Lauren and Ivan are old friends from New Rochelle. They go way back into the 80s, and they came up for the conference. So it's really a delight to have both of you here. And Lauren was especially praying for Joanna because he comes from a Jewish household very similar to the one that she was raised in, which would be Reformed Judaism, the most liberal wing, right? Or is it conservative?
Well, we've not been
so you're more like the Reformed. And he's a Yankees fan, so just don't harm him before he leaves. So, in any case, but you got right at it. It's some people would just say that just because you're having this sort of medical addition to Jim. Right. Oh, yeah. He will get to that. Sure. It messes up all kinds of things. But when you just think about the sexual relationship, there's a question, of course, of adultery comes up. Is it adultery? And some people would actually say this is adultery. And so what he does is he goes and looks at the only biblical examples that we see of this, and it would be what? Abraham and Jacob. And there he says this really doesn't apply because it actually involved adultery. That is to say, there was a sexual relationship. So that was inherently immoral. Then he goes to the only other possible biblical example, and this would be levirate marriage. And we're not going to spend a lot of time on this. It's just Deuteronomy 25. And he simply says, no, this is actually a command of Scripture that a brother raise up a seed if a husband dies, he raises up a seed for the husband if he doesn't have children, so that he will have carry on his name. So this was, and it has a redemptive import that you see in the book of Ruth that we don't have time to go into. But when you look at the seventh commandment, then, it's, while he concludes that it's not adulterous because there's no action, and we have to be careful. I hear Christians all the time using adulterous in a very broad way. And Jesus says that if you look upon a woman to lust, that's adultery. And yes, it's adultery in the heart, but it's not strictly what the seventh commandment is addressing. The actual sexual relationship has got to be present for it to be adultery, and it's not in any of these third-party scenarios. However, what it does do, and I like the way he puts this at the bottom of page 132, is that the third party in any of these three scenarios intrudes upon what ought to be the exclusive domain of the husband and wife. And so, in other words, while it's not adulterous, it doesn't mean that it's not problematic. And so we have then a complete process over in the middle of page 133. He says the entire process of the 9 months of pregnancy is the exclusive marital domain. And, you know, if we've been close to this again as grandparents, you know, over the last 5 years, we've seen three little ones come into the world, and especially when they're your own natural family, you get to see them and follow them closely. And I was pleased to hear that Rachel, most recently born, has listened to a lot of Mozart before she was born. And that's partly a joke, but the fact is that she recognizes also, her dad's voice. He has a very strong and unique voice, and she recognizes it. How did she do that? Well, she recognized it because she's already been hearing it for 9 months. So there, you know, the whole process, it's not just the sex act, but it's everything to do with the process of bearing children. And then finally the child comes into the world and it's all of a piece. And so the intimacy that the act of adultery is itself sort of, it sort of accents the problem in the seventh commandment. But the seventh commandment is protecting something far more intricate and profound. And that's what we should bring to bear on this question. And then he raises the very interesting question of choice. He doesn't use the word choice, actually, but he says, our contemporary social and political milieu tends to glorify consent as the overriding test of an act's morality and legality. But Christians should not be so foolish as to think that what they consent to cannot harm them or others. And so, you know, we worship choice in our culture. I mean, we truly worship choice in every arena. You know, it's why we have 500 channels on, the satellite television. It's the more choice, the better. And choice then becomes a central feature of modern ethical decision making. And he's saying it simply is not an adequate, it's not an adequate criterion to make these sorts of judgments. And so he also then raises this whole business of natural, or what our confession and catechism call ordinary generation. So that he's also bringing up this, the idea that family relations and self-identity are very important. And so what happens with, what have we seen? You're constantly seeing someone on television, on the news, with adopted children. And adoption, by the way, it can be, when it's done for the right reasons, a wonderful way of saving a human being from a bad situation. But what do they oftentimes, maybe even in adulthood, when they're, you know, older, what is it that they want to know that they don't know necessarily? They want to know who their parents are. That's because natural generation is an important part of our creaturehood. And so, and this is something that we, you know, every human being sort of resonates to this when a 60-year-old person finally comes to find their mother who's, you know, 85 or 90, and we see these things happening, and we all sort of rejoice and say, you know, it's usually they end up showing the happy reunions, and oftentimes, of course, the reason they're adopted is because there was something very unhappy that happened earlier in when they came into the world. But the fact is, he just uses this to illustrate the point that natural generation and the importance of it is something that is not to be ignored in thinking about all of this. And so he makes the statement at the bottom of page 134 that third-party parenthood arrangements intentionally create adoption scenarios. So this is very interesting now what he's doing as he's reasoning through this. What he takes for an illustration is really then becomes his next point, which is that the parents are actually creating, a third party is actually creating an adoption situation, a situation in which he'll be taken away from his birth mother or raised by someone other than his biological mother and father. And one of the things that's very interesting to me here is that he goes on to say that one of the problems that happens with surrogate motherhood, he may say this actually a bit later in this chapter, but is that what happens? What would you think if you were to raise ladies, someone else's, if you were to give birth to someone else's child, if you were a surrogate mother, what would be your instinct when this child was born after 9 months of pregnancy? You want to keep it. Absolutely. And again, this is what he's saying. I like the word intruding, because which he uses at the beginning of the section, because in a number of different ways, we're ending up intruding with our technological abilities into something that is far profounder and more sacred than modern people that look at life as being just physical or medical is accounting for. And so he then goes on to one of my... and then he goes at the end of this paragraph, in about the middle of 135, he says, I suggest that there should be a preference in favor of rescuing a child already in the situation, that is, of needing adoption, rather than creating a child to be in it. Notice he says, I suggest. He's not saying the Bible has a clear commandment on this, but he's looking at a biblical understanding of our humanity and really saying this would seem to be, I would say he'd say, extremely unwise to enter into any of these third-party arrangements. But then he looks at the business of commodification. What does commodification mean? This is a little difficult. I mean, we think of commodities. There's the commodities market, an area that you can invest. It's probably a fairly risky investment from what I understand. You can do food futures. If you think there's going to be a shortage of coffee, you can invest in this commodity. What is a commodity? What does he mean by this? He actually defines it somewhere a little below the middle of page 135. What is a commodity? And in what sense is this third-party arrangement, or one of these third-party arrangements, commodifying the reproductive process? Okay, here's an example. Think about the difference, and I get this from Ken Myers, an interview he did with someone who is a musicologist. And think of going to hear your favorite live band or orchestra. And especially if it was before the ability to record music, it would be local people, and you might know everyone in the band or the orchestra. You get together in your living room and you play music, you sing hymns or sing popular songs together, or you maybe people get together and play their violins and their cellos and a piano. But then it's recorded. And the recording industry, I know almost nobody. I'm trying to think if I know anybody in any of the orchestras or trios or quartets or anything that I, or the, let's say the Grateful Dead was one of my favorite rock groups. I never met these people. The only things I know about their personal lives I'm not impressed with, but the fact is they're not a part of my life. So the music then is commodified. It's separated from the personal relationships. It's divorced from the social context or matrix in which these realities take place. So the music is no longer, and it's interesting that we still have a propensity for live performance. No one would say, if Aerosmith is coming to town, no one would say, well, I've got the album. If you like Aerosmith, you want to be in Fenway Park on August, 15th, when they're going to be there. And they're going to play with the Jay Giles Band, by the way, if you're interested. Those are two of the best old rock and roll groups around. And they have a special connection, I guess, with Boston. But I wasn't planning on going, but if you like them, nothing will replace a live concert. Okay, so it's one step away from the commodification process. And so what he's saying here now is that all of our, what he calls procreative assets, all of what we've just talked about, this whole process of bringing children into the world, everything from the sexual dimension of it to the bringing the child into the world after 9 months, all of this, he's saying, is being commodified by the third-party arrangement. And so You know, another way of thinking about it is that we're just ripping apart the social fabric of our world in the 20th century, and technology is doing that in hundreds of different ways. You know, I think about technology such as all of the social networking that goes on. It's interesting to me that it's called social networking. And I'm not opposed to all of it either. I know grandparents that just love the fact that they can see their kids on Facebook, their grandchildren, because they live in California and they don't see them once a year. That's wonderful. But I also know people who don't know anyone face to face, hardly, except what they see on Facebook. And it actually takes so much time. I spoke to someone just recently who is not a believer, and they were just saying, I knew that I shouldn't get into Facebook because I would get addicted to it, and I would spend all my time contributing to commodification, ripping up the social fabric. So we need to be, and really this is, he doesn't talk about media ecology, but what David Van Drunen is doing in this book is he is looking from an ecological perspective at good stewardship of the technology. And he makes several points along the way. He makes the point that we are not against technological development. What we are against is the thoughtless use or even the sinful use of what is available. So he says, should sperm and egg be sold on the open market like bread or cars? That's a sobering statement that's meant to really get your attention. And of course, we as Christians would say, most definitely not. And so then he raises this very interesting question at the beginning of page 136, is should unmarried Christians consider artificial insemination or IVF? Why? Or why not? Lauren? Well, no, in this case, an unmarried Christian woman wanting to have artificial insemination and borrowing someone else's sperm, right. And so, but the woman, yeah, that's right, exactly. I was thinking of it from the woman's standpoint, but having a child that was not their own and without a husband. Right, and it's not, and there, in that case, it just is another way of saying that's intruding into the natural relationship. And it's interesting, a lot, there's a whole spate of literature now that's come out, you know, in recent years, and it tends to be the single mom, because moms are the ones that, especially when they're real little, would get the children in a court of law if there's a divorce or if there's a death. There are many reasons why there are single mothers, and we've had several in our congregation that have been single moms. And the you know, the 60s, sort of the Gloria Steinem, and then three decades after that, sort of gloried in this. We moms are capable of doing this on our own. Who needs dads? They're all, you know, male chauvinist pigs. We don't need them. They're just an appendage, a problem. And that was the attitude in a lot of the literature. Now you're seeing some new literature coming out and saying, oh, maybe that's not true. It might be important that both the dad and the mom, both male and female, provides the best context when they're committed to one another in marriage to raising children. It's sort of one of those no-brainer things for a Christian who reads when we read our Bibles, we realize that this is absolutely the case. But in the culture, everything's being redesigned, and so we have to be compassionately ready to come in and maybe raise questions about some of these things. And so he says, I conclude this subsection by considering briefly whether unmarried Christians who have a special love for children but adhere to the traditional Christian prohibition against extramarital sexual relations might pursue AID or IFV as a legitimate way to produce children that they intend to raise as single parents. And I think he simply says, no, it not really a very ideal or wise situation at all. Then he goes to what would be more within our moral purview, something that Christians might seriously consider, which is fertilization methods that involve the husband-wife only options. Now, some would say, well, yeah, if it's a husband-wife, it's using their sperm, their egg, what's the problem? And, of course, he raises some problems, which is one of his jobs in this book. And so there he brings in this new term, AIH, which is the artificial insemination using the husband's seed being inserted in the woman's body. And so he says, now that we're on the top of page 137, that these husband-wife-only options are morally superior to those that involve a third-party parent, and this is evidenced simply by noting how many of the ethical concerns raised above, that is, among the third-party arrangements, are irrelevant to the present case. So here the discussion comes closer to home, things that we might consider as Christians. And he brings in, he talks about the Roman Catholic view and basically which says that the child has to be produced through sexual intercourse. And he makes the statement, which I think is a great answer to this. I mean, it's a very legitimate concern, and there are ethicists within the Roman Catholic Church that say that it's immoral, therefore, for artificial insemination, even though it's the husband's sperm. But he says, if there is no moral necessity for every act of sexual intercourse to seek pregnancy as its goal, so remember when we talk about birth control, that's not immoral, and of course some Roman Catholics would say that it is, then there likewise seems to be no moral necessity for the union of a couple's sperm and egg to be linked to a specific act of sexual intercourse. And I think elsewhere he says, all other things being equal, that within a marriage where a healthy sexual relationship is part of their whole commitment to one another, that artificial insemination with a husband's sperm would not be in itself inherently immoral. And so, well, what other things then might be brought up about when it comes to these other types of... and actually, at the end of this section, which is the middle of 138, he says, AIH, that is artificial insemination with the husband's sperm, seems to be the morally preferable option if it is viable. Okay, so there is the the financial considerations and other things might be brought into it. But he says, then what makes IVF? Remember, that's in vitro fertilization, where you're connecting egg and sperm outside of the mother's womb, a more difficult moral choice. And he mentions three things. What are some of the things that would be a difficulty with the insemination happening outside of both bodies, let's say, and that's the way to think about IVF in vitro. It's test tube babies, I think is what we used to call that. Jen? Exactly. That's that's a huge. It's very expensive, these processes, and so financial considerations. And then what would be another one, Tom?
The number of embryos to that process.
Yeah, exactly. That's the biggest one. I think he also mentions the health of the mom, which of course is very important. But then that's always going to be somewhat of a judgment call. But when it comes to destroying embryos or freezing them for future use, it raises tremendous questions for the believer. And so that's really the focus then of his discussion at this point. And it is amazing. They can either be disposed of or frozen. And, of course, at that point, at that juncture in consideration, the Christian is going to say, well, of course, we wouldn't destroy them because that is clearly and absolutely immoral. It's breaking the sixth commandment. But we might freeze them. I mean, this technology is kind of mind-boggling. And apparently, sperm has been frozen for a long time. There are, sperm banks have been in existence for a couple decades at least. And now apparently also eggs and embryo may be frozen together. And so when, you know, what this adds moral difficulties. He says this adds a host of moral difficulties there on page 139. And the first one that he mentions there, this would be nearer to the end of that page, is all IVF procedures that make destruction of embryos an option built into the plan of action is clearly forbidden. So at least at some point, he says further on, in case all of the eggs are successfully fertilized, they have to be used at least at some point. So he's saying that that's certainly got to be a conclusion that Christians come to. But then what are the considerations that we have? What further considerations do we have? And these, again, these are very difficult to consider because, you know, you're thinking about the possibilities. For example, if you freeze the embryos, then what happens if one of the spouses dies? Okay, that creates a problem. Or what if the spouse who was making a very good living loses his job? One of the spouses loses his or hers or both jobs so that they can no longer afford to continue the process. So there are lots of contingencies that it simply, it expands the possibilities for problems he doesn't use this word, but I say in a sense it's like layaway children. You know, you're putting them away until you can pay for them or until you, in this case, decide that it's time to use those embryos. It seems to me to be a very, very problematic question. Now, what he raises a question which is not an easy one to answer, but I think he comes to a conclusion. What if the difficulties that might become apparent or become a reality during the time that these embryos are frozen for future use, if that's a problem with this procedure, what might, or Christians that aren't even considering any kind of biotechnology raised? Dave? Absolutely. And this is when we go back to what we were speaking about a little earlier. It can become a commodity. And in the worst sense, it becomes like selling bread or automobiles. But I was thinking more of what he says when he talks about the fact that ordinary Christians might say, well, maybe we shouldn't have children because of the contingencies of life. And his answer to this is, well, of course, these are two different things. They're really comparing apples and oranges, because what you're doing is you are inviting the possibilities of contingencies, negative contingencies, when you're prolonging this process, and you don't even know if you're going to use them. So, you know, a lot of times when we come to the end of our childbearing time in our marriages, we wonder. In fact, Robin was just saying this morning that both Dick Gaffin and his wife, and Dick's a little over a decade older, but he was saying back in 87, she remembered this from the conversation, that he said, well, we weren't sure. We were really kind of wanted four, but we weren't sure, and then before we knew it, it was too late. So we had gone through the same process. And so you choose that, but it doesn't involve the life of a person that doesn't exist. It's not the same as that frozen embryo. So there's a decision-making process in the natural order of childbearing that really is quite different from what this intrudes into that normal process. And then, of course, someone might say that you might want to have like a godparent, which would say, well, Will, if something happens to you, then I will bear your child. And, of course, then you get into the third-party arrangement and, again, creating adoption possibilities rather than adopting what is already a problem created in the circumstances of life. Very different. Ivan? No, that's right. And so what the conclusion that he comes to
is that only the number, and again, in the secular world, many die because they have to keep experimenting to get it to take in the woman's womb. But that only the exact number that are going to be immediately used would be an option ethically for a Christian. And he's really not recommending this, but he's certainly saying that these would be strictures that we would have to bring to bear on such technological possibilities for the Christian. Now, I'm amazed that we're actually going to do this again. I guess there was wisdom in dividing the chapters in half, because it is doable to cover this, even though we don't answer all possible questions. The idea, by the way, is that for the next 2 weeks, we'll be going over the final chapter, which is chapter 6, and dividing that into two parts. And then, as I talked with Landon and Jim, we decided that it would be wise to maybe put off the end of life until the fall. And then we'll deal with that in the fall, and we'll also deal with something that's not in the book, which is grief. And so that's the plan at this point. So any questions at this point about all these questions of artificial fertilization? Or comments? Ivan and then Jen? See, it sounds like you read the book, because we had talked about that a few way back at the beginning of this section of the book, which is dealing with beginning of life issues. And basically, he says exactly that this is a God-given desire to have children, but it's not the most important thing in life. And this is where there can be a tension. Like you say, it can blind us. Good things have a tendency to do that. They can blind us to the realities that should be considered along with the desire, and in this case, to have children. So thank you for making that good point. Jen? The last part of it, I was thinking now that you're talking about the Roman Catholic not using contraception. Oh, I see what you mean, yes.
By doing that, you continue to create sort of a commodity aspect to the sexual act. So I think you can arm me with some thoughts on that, because it's sort of ongoing.
Yeah, no, that's an excellent question. And see, I think that what he doesn't spend a lot of time on this, but in thinking about the idea of commodity, and his specific answer to that, you might want to even copy this section of the book for them, because he addresses this question of the Roman Catholic, though not quite from the angle that you're looking at it. Right, and so I think what we want to say is that traditional Roman Catholic theology, and I think going all the way back to Augustine, and remember, Augustine himself struggled with sexual sin prior. He was living with someone before he became a Christian. And then he introduced the monastic tradition. It was there, but I mean, he really reinforced that with his theology. And I think it was partly a reaction to his own sinful past. And so what you get then is this very strong strain that sex is to make babies, to put it crudely. That's what it's for. And the idea of the Song of Solomon, that there is also, that it is actually, it's the main fruit, let's say, of the marital relation, but that there is something, that fruit grows from something that is a beautiful and profound intimacy between two human beings, which involves joy and pleasure. And so, to say that there's commodification there, I think, is really to miss the context in which children are born, and the fact that they would believe that you can prevent having children naturally They're still making a choice. And in a sense, the method of choosing not to have children, if they're going to say that birth control, artificial birth control is commodification, I don't see how that really differs from the other. But I don't think either are commodification, given a healthy marriage. Jim? That's what you're saying the Roman Catholic view does. Yes, it does. In its purest form, it does. Now, I don't know whether this particular couple holds to the fact that it would be sinful if you don't have the intention of having children. Probably not if they believe in artificial, if they believe in natural birth control. So.
Yeah, it's something about the artificial nature if you know your wife is fertile and you don't want to have children and you engage in a sexual act anyway and you use some kind of artificial way of preventing approach the child, that is a sinful act. The sinful act is depriving through a condom or whatever type of contraception. That deprivation is the sin.
Yeah, and I think asking them a question along the lines of what Jim is saying, do you think that sex apart from the intention of having children is itself a good or is it sinful? That would be interesting to find out if that's what they think. So, and also, you should go through, I could actually go through, I think I have the text all in one document on my computer as well, and go through and just, I'll send it to you actually, and then you could go through it and just search for Roman Catholic or Roman Catholicism, because he discusses these things in a number of different places in the book, at least two other places besides this, and that might help. Are you asking that question, or you're saying ask them that question? That's right. And what do they think the Song of Solomon means? Okay. We only have a couple of minutes here, and I don't think human cloning is a pressing issue for anyone here. But it's interesting, and I'd really encourage you to read. It's only a couple, three pages on human cloning. Because it's a very perceptive, it's not a reality yet. Okay. So no one is asking this question. Practically, it's being asked theoretically, and of course, practical answers come only when we think theoretically, first of all, and so it's an important one. And what it really is it simply is, it's copying the exact genetic makeup of the woman is copying it. And so then the questions he raises are all in this nexus of what is marriage, and what is human identity, and what is the ordinary generations that go from, the connections that go from one generation to another, and human cloning just radically alters and intrudes in this in a way that's just, really, it's unimaginable. He raises the question, would there be a soul in such a person? And he basically says, of course, if a person is a living, thinking human being, there is a soul there, even though we don't understand how souls, which is the invisible part of human beings, come into existence. And he talks about the two basic theories of traducianism and creationism there, which I found interesting. One of the most interesting thing he says, and we'll close on this note, is in the middle of page 143, he talks about the prideful reasons, or let's say the sinful reasons that people would want human cloning. I just think it was such an insight into human sinfulness, and I think it also comes from his reading in the secular literature on human cloning as to why people would want to do such a thing. And one is just genetic pride. You know, someone who is extremely bright and gifted and good looking would say, yeah, the world needs more of me. I mean, that's probably the worst. Most of us, if we're at all humble, would realize that probably one of us is just about enough. But that would be one reason. And then also the rejection of the need for marriage, which is a huge thing. that's happening in the world around us today. And then also vicarious living. You know, I'm 60, and I was never a great athlete. And I want to be an athlete through this child that will be my genetic copy. And so you can, or, you know, a great scholar or whatever you might choose, you could live it through your children. Of course, parents do this without cloning, and it's a psychologically and spiritually, I think, a big mistake. And then finally, the replacing a deceased child. That would be, honestly, the more understandable one, but at the same time, none of these really match up to being good reasons for doing this. But his main argument against it is that it intrudes in a most fundamental and radical way into the ordinary generation and the relationship of marriage and the family. And I found that to be quite persuasive. I would imagine that in our lifetimes we will probably see this become a practical question in the world, and therefore as well in the church. So, any final questions or comments? Lauren? Right. Well, that's right. And that's why, you know, Song of Solomon, of course, is the traditional one. And then also from Hebrews, that the marriage bed is undefiled. It's very clear. There's also Proverbs 5 is another place where the enjoyment of the sexual dimension of the marriage relationship is something that's wonderful. It's a funny thing. We tend to overreact against the best things in life, the abuse of them. And as Christians, we can sometimes overreact to that. So wine would be another one. You know, it's just clear. There's so many places in the Bible where it's clear that wine is a blessing. It's used for an analogy of the ultimate glory that we're going to enjoy in the new heavens and the new earth at the marriage supper of the Lamb, according to the little apocalypse of Isaiah. We're going to have vintage wine, not just regular wine. So it's in that same category. And it's understandable because as rebels and sinners, we abuse the creation and all the wonderful gifts that God has given to us. And so it's understandable that we might overreact, but we want to be careful as Christians not to.